This recording was made at a public hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on Wednesday, January 25th. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Okay, why don't we reconvene?
Yes.
The special session of the Federal Election Commission regarding coordinated communications. Our second panel this morning consists of Mark Elias on behalf of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and Paul Ryan on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center, and Larry Gold on behalf of the AFL-CIO. As with the first panel today, each witness on this panel will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. The green light at the witness table will start to flash when the person speaking has 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on when the speaker has 30 seconds left, and the red light means that it's time to wrap up your remarks. Once again, we'll go alphabetically among the witnesses, starting with Mr. Elias and then Mr. Gold and Mr. Ryan. So, Mr. Elias, whenever you're ready to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two goals here. One is to use less than my full 5 minutes, since I know there are a lot of, you've heard a lot of statements from a lot of people and probably have questions. Second is I wanted to welcome, Mr. Chairman, you to the chairman's seat, Commissioner Lenhardt, you to the commission and the vice chairman's seat, and Mr. Spakovsky, welcome to the Federal Election Commission. I'm looking forward to testifying today. I have commented in the past few rulemakings at the opening that you are largely balancing the number of angels you can get on the head of a pin. And we did that first about what the definition of agent is, and then we did it even more in some senses with less practical effect over the definition of solicit. But I understand why you had to do it. I understand it was a court order and there was no choice. With the internet rulemaking, I think I began by saying that this was a rulemaking in search of a problem, and I also reiterated that again in the context of the agency and the solicit rulemakings. This is a very different situation you find yourselves in. Speaking on behalf of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the rulemaking that you all are engaged in today goes to not just real differences in approach of practical consequence and policy, but it goes to the heart of, frankly, what national party committees today do. And I say that in a mild moment of bipartisanship. The fact is that the National Republican Senatorial Committee, like the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, this cycle, as last, will run millions of dollars, most likely tens of millions of dollars, in independent expenditure public communications. So the decisions you all make in this rulemaking, unlike in some of the others, have real-world consequences. They have real-world consequences for how parties operate, how parties establish themselves, how parties organize themselves, and the relationship, the fundamental, and I would say the constitutional relationship, between parties and their candidates. I am reminded as I sit here of something that several of you have said in various contexts over the time that with respect to the DSCC and its Republican counterpart, we are talking about hard money committees. So whatever rules that this commission may feel are appropriate with respect to 527s or other organizations, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee only raises funds subject to the prohibitions and reporting requirements of the Federal Election Campaign Act and McCain-Feingold. The DSCC does not raise or spend, transfer, or direct soft money, a point that I have raised in the definition of solicit. It does not do anything approaching those things. So the activities that you are regulating today go to the relationship that the DSCC will have with its candidates, the relationship the DSCC will have with its allies, and the relationship that the DSCC will have internally, to the extent that under current commission regulation and practice, the DSCC, like most other organizations, essentially divides itself in half as we draw closer to the elections, so that there is a part of the DSCC that is independent and there is a part of the DSCC that is coordinated. So I ask you to keep that in mind as you approach this from a 30,000 feet level, as you approach this from a policy level, that this is a hard money committee, a committee that is composed of Democratic elected officials, where the risk of corruption, I think, is considerably more attenuated than in some of the other areas that you may have focused on in some of the other rulemakings. For that reason, as we review the court's order to you, to go back and re-examine this rulemaking, we have urged several specific proposals upon you, and I'm not going to list them here because you've undoubtedly read the comments, and as I said, I don't want to take my full 5 minutes. I want to let you get to.
You're
the
well on your way, Mr.
I'm almost done, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I'm watching a little light. All of the comments we offer fall into two categories. Number one is to deal specifically with the court's ruling on the time period and the content standard and the conduct standard. The second is having, since you are revisiting this rulemaking, having had a cycle of experience about some glitches in the law that have developed, some of the advisory opinions that have come up, we've taken this opportunity to try to help you all reflect back on how this standard has worked, how this law has worked in the real world. So those are the two things that I'm here today to answer questions about, and with that I will conclude with at least some time left because the little yellow light is still on.
Mr. Elias, your presentation was precise. You concluded with 3 seconds remaining. Thank you. Mr. Gold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of the AFL-CIO, which has 9 million members and 52 national and international union affiliates. We have a longstanding concern with the Commission's regulation of coordination. We participate in previous rulemakings for that reason. As you know, were a litigant in the McConnell litigation on coordination rules arising under BCRA, and we have appeared as an amicus at the district court level, the appellate court level, and the Supreme Court level, most recently in the pending Randall versus Sorrell case on coordination matters. The AFL-CIO does all this because it engages regularly with candidates and with political parties. It engages with legislators on matters of public policy and legislation. It mobilizes its members on issues and legislative matters, and it also does a great deal of public advocacy on all these matters. So we intersect with the legislative and the political world in many different ways throughout the country. In this rulemaking, the Commission is constrained and governed by the Constitution, by the statute, and by the directives of the Shays decision. Arising from BCRA, BCRA gave the Commission a fair degree of latitude when it repealed the previous coordination rules. Originally, the statute, it should be remembered, the original proposal had a very precise and thorough and complicated proposal to regulate coordination. By the end of the legislative process, that had been abandoned in favor of repealing the regulations and essentially punting the matter to the Commission with very little guidance. And that was because it was a rather insuperable process. Without going through the history of where you are, the Shays Court rejected one aspect of coordination regulations, but in doing so, it did not accept the district court's notion that you could have a regulation that only had a conduct standard, and affirmed the necessity to use time, place, and content elements in order to find, as the court put it, an objective bright-line rule that does not unduly compromise the purposes of the Act, and where you should not regulate where there's only a weak nexus to an election. The court said you must establish a rule that rationally separates election-related advocacy from other advocacy falling outside FECA's expenditure definition. Truly, it is really important to construct a careful conduct standard, both in order to comply with the legal directives, but also to avoid a basic chill in associational activity and speech, to make sure that your regulation focuses on activity that truly is election-influencing and has an electoral effect. And it is necessary as a practical matter to the Commission so you have an administrable RTB standard. Absent some kind of content guidance, you will be, as we have experienced, as I have experienced as a lawyer for organizations, you can easily be at a point where, due to circumstantial facts arising in complaints, easily tip into opening investigations that almost always become very complex and involved unless you have a legitimate and adequate filter that will screen out cases that you just should not be devoting your resources to. And it's very necessary to protect lobbying activity and legislative engagement between groups and individuals and public officials. Indeed, both Senators McCain and Feingold explicitly acknowledged that in the course of the fashioning of BCRA, and so did the Chase Court. And I must say, one case that was not referred to hasn't been referred to yet today, unless I missed it. The Supreme Court's decision this week in the Wisconsin Right to Life case, it's a fairly spare decision, but it certainly stands for the proposition that some speech within a very narrow time frame broadcast that inside a candidate's jurisdiction that refers to the candidate, some of that is constitutionally protected and cannot be captured by the electioneering communication provision. That in itself, I think, makes some of the proposals, some aspects of the proposals by Democracy 21, Campaign Legal Center, and the like, legally unacceptable. We have proposed, in short, that the Commission focus on fashioning a safe harbor that accommodates these concerns, and we've set that forth in our comments. The basic elements, just very quickly, are that whatever standard you adopt, it must preserve, and I see my time is up. So
you have my 3 seconds.
Okay. It essentially is preserving what we believe is something that captures the legislative function and in the legislative engagement communications to saying that groups must be able to engage with and even coordinate with public officials. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Mr. Ryan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Commissioners, Commission staff. It's a pleasure to be here this morning to comment on this rulemaking on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center, which I serve as Associate Legal Counsel. The Campaign Legal Center submitted detailed written comments in this rulemaking, together with Democracy 21 and the Center for Responsive Politics. As detailed in our written comments, we oppose the alternative revisions to the content standards of 11 CFR Section 109.21C, proposed in NPRM 2005-28, because none of the alternatives effectively implement FECA as amended by BCRA. We urge the Commission instead to revise the content standards in the manner set forth in our written comments, an approach which includes elements of several of the alternatives presented in the NPRM. Federal law requires all expenditures coordinated with a candidate or political party committee to be deemed contributions to such candidate or party committee. FECA, in turn, defines the term expenditure to include payments for the purpose of influencing a federal election. Yet the Commission's current coordination regulation exempts from coverage payments for many ads clearly intended to influence federal elections. The Circuit Court in Shays ordered this Commission to carefully consider whether candidates do, in fact, limit campaign-related advocacy to the 4 months surrounding elections. The court indicated that if candidates do not limit campaign activity to the 120-day pre-election time period, then the Commission's current regulation permits exactly what BCRA aims to prevent, evasion of campaign finance restrictions through unregulated collaboration. The appendices to our written comments contain the scripts of more than 200 television and radio ads distributed more than 120 days before an election, which we believe the ads were clearly intended to influence, including many ads by candidates themselves, which had the undeniable purpose of influencing those candidates' elections. Under the current regulation, these ads could have been designed by a candidate and paid for by a corporation, labor union, or other entity. Consequently, the administrative record in this rulemaking shows that the current coordination regulation does, in fact, permit exactly what BCRA aims to prevent, circumvention of the FECA restrictions on both source and amounts of contributions to federal candidates and parties. No revised explanation and justification of the current rule will change the simple fact. The task at hand for this commission, therefore, is to develop a more inclusive content standard for the regulation of public communications made for the purpose of influencing a federal election, and our proposed regulation would accomplish this task. Finally, despite the fact that the district and circuit courts expressed grave concerns that the current coordination rule is too narrow in its scope, several commenters in this rulemaking have recommended that the commission further narrow its content standards to apply only to the 30 or 60-day periods preceding elections. We urge the Commission not to do so. Further narrowing the coordination rule will only exacerbate the problems that the courts have ordered this Commission to remedy. Doing so would likewise unduly compromise the intent and purposes of FECA and BCRA. Thank you for your attention. I look forward to answering any questions you might have to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Our first questioner will be the Vice Chairman. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll start with you, Mr. Ryan. You've submitted documents that reflect that there were a number of ads that occurred outside of the 120-day time period. And the question I guess I'd like to try and get at is how significant is this? Do you have a sense of what percentage of the money that was spent in those cycles this constitutes? Is this a lot or a little? Do you have any quantifiable measure of how significant this is?
Well, as a baseline matter, I think the 200-plus ads indicate that it is a significant issue. I think
If I could interrupt for just, do you know how many ads were run in that time period? Overall?
I do not, but we do not challenge the proposition that the majority of campaign ads are run in very close proximity to an election, but we don't believe that such a fact is really the relevant question for this commission to be asking. The circuit court directed this commission to look into whether or not candidates run ads more than 120 days out, and they do.
Okay, if I could just interrupt again, as we try and discern where the line should be, is there any level of advertising that would be so small or of such limited relevance that we could safely fail to regulate it, or does the line have to extend to every ad, the farthest limits of what we might find in the record?
Well, I think with regard to the temporal limit, the 120-day line that has been drawn by this commission in the 2002 rulemaking, the problem with that line is that it creates a situation in which no ads outside of that line, or almost no ads, those ads that do not include express advocacy or republication of campaign materials, go completely unregulated. So we don't take issue with the drawing of a temporal line per se, and I'm not sure if there would be a better line than 120 days, say 100 days, 140 days. What we are concerned with is the complete exemption or near complete exemption of ads running more than 120 days before an election from this commission's regulations, and that's why we have suggested this commission and even urged this commission to supplement this 120 day time frame with standards that capture ads which we believe clearly influence or are intended to influence federal elections that run more than 120 days before the election.
Okay, and a question I asked Don Simon, I'll ask you as well. Do you have a sense of those ads that fall outside of the 120-day time period, whether the majority or what percentage of those are occurring in the pre-primary period as opposed to the pre-general election period?
I think our greatest concern is with the period preceding the general election, the gap between the primary elections and the general elections. And as you're all well aware, in the 2004 presidential election, the Democratic Party's nominee essentially had a lock on the nomination in March. And from that time forward, it was no secret that party committees and independent groups and the candidates themselves began their national advertising campaigns aimed at the general election. Nevertheless, because these ads were more than 120 days before the general election, the cutoff line of which was somewhere early in July, they did not fall within the scope of this commission's regulation. So to reiterate, our biggest concern is with that gap between primary and general elections, but we are likewise concerned with the substantial number of ads that we found record for having run in more than 120 days prior to the primary election itself. And this is particularly the case with regard to congressional elections, where the primary election is generally much closer to the general election than it is in the primary election campaign. So in the context of congressional ads, most of the ads in our appendices ran more than 120 days prior to the primary election, simply because we had no period between the primary and general to look at, because the distance between the two was less than 120 days.
Okay. Mr. Gold, what is the harm? We're trying to decide whether to expand the regulatory scope, and you talked about lobbying and its impact on First Amendment speech. And yet the legal standard here involves coordination, and why is there a need to coordinate your lobbying activities with candidates or parties, or is there another element of harm that's occurring here by the imposition of these regulations?
Well, I think there are several aspects to harm. There is harm, and there's potential harm. One is just a general chilling effect. I mean, the fact is that any regulations that you promulgate, they're generally not well understood by those who actually have to live under them. Their counsel can have time, and they're paid, and it's their job to understand them. And this is not a reason not to regulate. Obviously, you have to come up with some fairly careful distinctions and sometimes complicated ones. But there is a general sense that if you deal with an office holder, you've got to be very wary. And there is a general chilling effect from that. And the broader the rules are, the more extensive the rules are, the more the chilling effect is. The other is, to answer your precise question, I think the answer is yes. There are circumstances where you have to, it's desirable to, and there's good public reason to coordinate your advocacy with candidates when they're office holders, specifically, most particularly, incumbent legislators when you have a common cause with them on a particular issue. You're trying, whether it's for the AFL-CIO's point of view, it's blocking Social Security reform, it's promoting an increase in the minimum wage, it's trade policy. There's regular engagement with members of Congress on this, and hopefully with an administration, a friendly administration, and you want to work with them in order to advance legislative goals. Part of that is influencing the public, which then, of course, influences Congress. So the harm is, sweeping rules that prevent or can convert those contacts into a predicate for finding coordination or preclude coordination if the communications you do actually mention legislators and the like. That can be a real problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. Mr. Gold, I think I understand your focus on the lobbying safe harbor. And I appreciate that, and I think it's helpful and productive to sort of get us focused on, to whatever degree we can exactly or inexactly say what's prohibited, that for lobbying purposes it might also be very useful to say what's clearly permitted. But I'm not sure I quite grasp what your comments or suggestions are in terms of what we do with the rest of the rule. I mean, you seem to say that you don't see any way to justify 120 days. You don't really see any basis to justify any of these other periods. And so do you have anything for us on that question of what's the main rule?
No, it's a very appropriate question because we've wrestled with, how do you define it? We know really what should be excluded, but what are the indicia that would fairly capture what you should cover? We haven't proposed a 120-day standard. It's not that we wouldn't want one or even a smaller time frame. Under the Shays decision, it's difficult. I think you can craft one and try again with a better explanation and use what's in the record before you. And I don't believe what incidentally, Mr. Ryan's groups have submitted as compelling in that manner. So I don't have a well-developed answer to you for what the rest of it should be, but it should include, we believe, communications that the content should include references to candidates or parties. There should be a targeting aspect to it. I think we could say that it should not, if you can define it, comment on candidate-type aspects. It shouldn't refer to candidacy. It should not refer, perhaps, to qualifications as a candidate, fitness for office, and the like. But beyond that, I think we don't venture to say. But there does have to be an absolute content that the safe harbor basically is an exception from. We acknowledge. We just haven't fully developed.
And your proposal focuses on the content of the ad, and specifically, for instance, you suggest that we ought to make clear that by referring somebody to an 800 number or a website, either place they might get other information, maybe more directly electoral information. You think we should exclude that you know, those secondary sources from the scope of the rule, if I understand your testimony.
Yes.
Or your comment. I just wanted to ask the question. It seems to me, and you mentioned Wisconsin right to life, that that's potentially problematic because that seemed to be one of the issues that was specifically raised in Wisconsin right to life and, of course, not resolved by the court, where the factual situation that was described there was that they had a website, and when you went to the website, you got all this other information, and wasn't that relevant. So what do you suggest that we do about that? Because, you know, depending on how the courts ultimately come down on that issue, presumably, while it wouldn't, you know, be directly applicable here, it would certainly be highly suggestive.
Right. Well, I think you always have this problem. You're always developing regulations in a dynamic legal environment. And that's been true for years. It's certainly been true since 2002. It'll continue to be so. For the time being, you have this decision that was issued earlier this week, and it certainly stands for the proposition that an absolute ban on union and corporate paid ads within 30-60-day periods that refer to candidates is not constitutional, that there have to be exceptions, and the court must have meant exceptions that refer to legislative and lobbying-type matters because that was really the context in which it was presented. How the three-judge court deals with that issue eventually, and it could be a long time before they finally resolve this case. It was decided on preliminary injunction.
No, I'm not suggesting we wait, and that's the problem. Well,
I think you're just going to have to do the best you can.
Let me move on to one more, and it may require a quick response, and maybe I'll come back to it if I have time. Your organization has, or your organizations, the unions that are members of your federation, typically have the union. Many of them have PACs. And many of them have 527 organizations that they relate to or fund or whatever. So what are the implications if we establish different standards for those three different types of entities? In other words, how do we enforce a rule that places one content standard on a 527, another one on the union, and yet a third on the PAC, when in fact it's the same lobbyist frequently? A lot of times that's a person who's going to be touching all three, who's involved in each of the three.
Yeah, and we're not proposing that you do the kind of thing that the Campaign Legal Center et al. Are proposing. We don't propose different standards for.
But what I'm asking is, wouldn't that be a problem? I mean, because under the tax rules and other rules, there's no barrier to the same individual within these related organizations from doing union work, you know, paid for and you know, under the aegis of the union, and political work under the aegis of the PAC, and
right.
And related.
I think that's basically correct. I mean, that shouldn't drive regulation to be sort of most restrictive towards the most restrictive or the most overtly universally political of those entities, which would be a federal PAC. But it doesn't seem to me that it's appropriate to, certainly on 527s, to have different standards than for other entities.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ryan, you have, excuse me, I forgot what I was going to ask you. Isn't that awful? Okay, I got it. It goes back to something that Mr. Simon was saying earlier, but you're on the same set of comments, so I get to ask you. You've indicated that you're concerned about the what happens before the 120 days, what you see as a virtual vacuum of regulation out there. And the scenario that Mr. Simon posited was outside of the 120 days, a candidate could go up to a corporation or union and say, here's my ad, please pay for it. And that wouldn't be covered. But wouldn't a situation like that, which frankly I don't think is very likely to happen, I'm not aware of things like that happening too often. It's people tend not to be quite that blatant. But wouldn't such a situation, couldn't we capture that under 441B anyway, even without going to coordination, in the same way that if a candidate walked up to a corporation or a union and said, here, please pay my phone bill, please pay my consultant bill, here, please run my ad. I mean, can't we get at that anyway?
I'm not confident that the Commission's existing regulations would get at that, and perhaps you could point me to an advisor opinion or something to that effect that would allay my fears that type of activity that Mr. Simon that Mr. Simon predicted could occur, it would not occur. Some guidance that this commission has given, but
we don't need a coordination rule to preclude the situation where the candidate says, "Here, pay my phone bill."
But if you determine that a public communication that meets or fails to meet the standards that you do explicitly set forth in your regulations does not constitute an expenditure, which I think is the effect of public communications not falling within your current rule, then I don't know if the phone bill may be deemed an expenditure, and consequently the request that a corporation pay for it would be a violation. I'm not certain that, given the way that you've structured such detailed regulations, activity that explicitly does not fall within them but is a public, meets the definition of public communication, but is explicitly not coordinated under your own regulations, would be covered by the commission's regulations.
Mr. Elias, I see you leaning forward towards the mic.
This is actually a replay of the same discussion we had about the Internet. Yeah. And I said then I find myself surprisingly on the more regulatory side of the debate with the campaign, with Democracy, I think in that case it was with Don Simon. But, the commission is in part doing this rulemaking against the facts as they exist. Because, after all, you craft rules not in the abstract, but in the concrete to deal with real-world situations. If, in fact, the permissive interpretation were widely accepted among the regulated, why aren't we doing it? I mean, I'll go back to one example, and I'm here on behalf of the DSCC today, but as many of you know, I was the general counsel to the Kerry Edwards campaign. We didn't coordinate any of those ads. Inside 120 days, outside of 120 days, I mean, if there were this belief that corporations and labor unions could fund on a fully coordinated basis, here's our ad, please go run it, then frankly the two of us would spend a lot more time on the phone together. And you'd be seeing a lot more advertising saying paid for by the AFL-CIO that was supportive of Democrats, and presumably Jan Barron's client, the Chamber of Commerce, you'd be seeing a lot more ads saying paid for by the Chamber of Commerce outside 120 days. The fact is, we're, as a factual matter, for the record, that you all are using to build a new set of regulations, I think it's important to distinguish that which becomes an academic debate among campaign finance lawyers and that which is the actual practice. The fact is, there is a paucity of evidence, at least in my experience, there is a paucity of evidence of ads run outside of these time periods, whether it's 60-day, 30 days, or 120 days, whatever it is, that are sort of handed off to outside groups and funded on that basis.
If you could receive some assurance on that ground, would it make you feel better, Mr. Ryan?
Part of the problem is that the hypothetical that you present, Mr. Simon's, and I think it's a valid hypothetical, it entails an interpretation of what the term expenditure means relative to a corporation or another type of separate segregated fund, or corporation or labor union, rather. And the Supreme Court said in Buckley that more guidance with regards to these non-political committee entities is required, and narrowly construed the term expenditure to include only express advocacy. Therefore, the types of public communications that you're saying would quite possibly or would in fact be covered by your regulations, I think a strong argument could be made and would be made by the attorneys representing those entities that, hey, this isn't even an expenditure. We don't include express advocacy. We don't meet your own regulations, definitions of what's covered by 441B, which are contributions and expenditures.
Right, but I just want to go back, though, to the premise of at least what I think is most significant for you all, which is that campaign finance lawyers can sit here and debate what 441B would cover and wouldn't, and in the MER process, you're right, it would all get hashed out back and forth. But the fact is, you all are here to write regulations against the facts of the real world, of what has actually gone on. And you have an advantage this time that you didn't have 2 years ago, which is we have lived under a cycle of McCain-Feingold and under a cycle of a time period of 120 days. Now, there are those of us who think that that's not the right time period, but we've lived under a time period. So you have some real-world experience with what does that mean to how parties and candidates organize their affairs. And I would posit again that I think that there is a real paucity of evidence out there that suggests that kind of hard cutoff has led to the kind of wholesale ad handing off of offing that Mr. Simon suggested.
My time's up. Could I let Mr. Gold put in a couple of words on this? Because he seemed like, did you have something you wanted to say?
No, I think that's absolutely right. That's a critical point, and I want the record to be clear that that is the AFL-CIO's experience, and my experience as a lawyer as well, representing a number of organizations, is that it just doesn't happen. And in fact, in one sense, is a real fact, the 120 days did not matter in the last cycle, in that I don't know of anybody who was coordinating their public communications, you know, before that in any kind of electoral sense. I just don't. And I don't believe that that's how organizations are likely to operate and candidates are likely to operate if that number were eliminated. You know, let me just one other point about the so-called evidence, the appendices that were presented. You know, I searched through that and I found an AFL-CIO ad. There is one AFL-CIO ad in that stack. It's an ad. It's Appendix 4, page 54. It's an advertisement that the AFL-CIO ran in a number of places in May of 2004, 6 months before the general election, not coordinated with anybody, let me hasten to say, but regardless. It was soon after President Bush had announced his Mars plan. Remember, we were going to spend $100 billion and go to Mars. And that was, you know, and that was greeted with tremendous public ridicule. That was not a campaign statement. He was the president of the United States. He was running for re-election, but he was the president of the United States. We ran an ad that interspersed little excerpts from that speech with ordinary people saying our priorities should be, what about jobs? What about health care? What about Medicare? $100 billion to send a man to Mars. I'm paraphrasing a bit. Tell President Bush that our priorities must be closer to home. Now, they have blithely characterized that. That's the election. It's all about the election, and I don't think you should accept the premise that everything in their stack that is not out of the mouths of candidates and parties is, quote, electoral. But that was a very legitimate public communication about what Congress should be doing, what the executive branch should be doing, and the fact that the President of the United States is a candidate cannot possibly disable us from having some contact with some candidate, somebody out there, a member of Congress, who is pushing for Medicare or jobs programs and the like, or is dead set against the space program expanding in the way he did it. That this cannot possibly constitutionally or in any reasonable sense, I would submit, disable us from being able to have any kind of traffic with a member of Congress about having that kind of public advocacy at that time.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Elias, by the way, you passed your first test. You pronounced my name correctly, so thank you for that. In your testimony, you talk about the fact that, as currently written, the coordination rules could apply to communications between your organization and third parties in a state where there's no Senate candidate on. And I'm wondering, give me a practical example of that, and is that going to prevent, going back to an earlier example I used, of senators, for example, getting involved in and endorsing ballot initiatives and things like that?
It is one of these quirks of McCain of the McCain-Feingold regulations. I don't think it's compelled by the statute, obviously, but and it's perhaps another way of getting at the issue that Mr. Gold is raising more broadly, which is that we at the senatorial committees have to deal with the fact that because of the agency regulations, we are constantly vigilant to what is being coordinated with us because groups are talking to our members. So a group comes in and says, we're going to run a minimum wage ad, and it's going to be national in scope. I think this is right. If I'm not, I'm sure someone will correct me. But I believe, as we stand here right now, the only place we are within 120 days of an election is Illinois. Okay, there is no Senate race in Illinois. It's not that there's no race and that there's not a competitive race. There is no Senate race in Illinois. So right now, I have to deal with the question of, well, what do I do if the AFL-CIO wants to come in and talk to Democratic senators about running an ad in Illinois on the minimum wage? You know, the question is, well, are they agents of the national party when they're having the conversations? Is it somehow, you know, I mean, we go through the whole analysis, but to the extent that there is no Senate race in that state, it strikes me that it is a pretty easy and clean and quick and I think non-controversial, although I'm sure I'll hear otherwise, if it is, fix to say, you know what, in those circumstances, we're just going to say that since it is essentially not targeted, since targeting is a component that you all have built into the regs, which I think make sense, since it is not targeted to the electorate that your committee cares about at all. We're not going to apply the coordination rules.
Mr. Long, in your testimony, you talk on page 16 about the safe harbor proposed alternative number 4, and with some modifications, you recommend that to us. Tell me how you would apply that in real life to real situation, and how you think it would work.
Okay. Well, the elements of the safe harbor are essentially, you know, communication that is devoted to a particular legislative or executive branch matter. Whether or not it is specifically pending for a specific action imminently, it is a matter that is before the legislative or executive branch, urges members of the public or encourages them to contact office holder who's a candidate to take some position, to take some action, even if it does refer to some other source for further information, such as a website, does not refer to an election or candidacy. It may refer to the record of the office holder who is mentioned or the position that's taken. That's part of what makes an effective legislative and advocacy ad. No reference to character or qualifications for office. Primarily targeted where that the office holder's jurisdiction, and we also suggest a threshold that is borrowed, if you will, from the electioneering communication rules of 50,000 persons being able to receive it. How that would work is it would enable, for example, the AFL-CIO to do the kinds of things that I mentioned. If the AFL-CIO had coordinated in some manner through any of the conduct standards, the Bush Mars ad, for example, with an office holder who is a candidate, a member of Congress, a member of the Senate, and the like, the AFL-CIO would have known that it could do that. And the real-world impact is that you know you have a legislative and a policy agenda, you realize there's an election, you're trying to navigate through all these regulations and accomplish your issue goals, your legislative goals, you know that you can do something, and you know that there's basically no legal risk for doing so. And that is just, it removes a layer of doubt from something that is truly legitimate, whereas absent some kind of safe harbor or some kind of affirmative standard that is sufficiently, you know, broad to include this, these questions always come up, and you always have to temper what you're doing, and you may decide on balance, when you know that you're under scrutiny, especially if you are a significant organization like the AFL, that you might not do it. So it will have a real-world effect, and it can only encourage, to me, I think, legitimate advocacy and grassroots activity and engagement that is healthy.
Mr. Ryan, I take it you disagree with this kind of safe harbor.
Yes, I do disagree with it. Our organization and the comments that we submitted have been roundly criticized for being overly complicated, but the critics of our proposal submitted written comments on their own, suggesting the creation of a variety of different safe harbors that would likewise further complicate the coordination regulations that you have on the books. And we believe that the creation of any new safe harbors, the further narrowing of the current content standards or conduct standards for that matter, would be entirely inconsistent with the reasoning of the circuit court and the district court in Shays.
Mr. Ryan, the kind of strict coordination rules that your group is proposing is entirely opposite of the way European politics is conducted. I mean, the parties very much still do fundraising, help run campaigns for candidates, so forth. The whole reason urged by your organizations and the other organizations that have submitted these comments is to prevent corruption, the appearance of corruption. Given that these kind of rules don't apply in European campaigns and politics, can you cite to me specific examples of corruption or the appearance of corruption within those European campaigns?
I'm no expert on European politics, and I won't pretend to be one in this context.
Let me ask you another question. Your predecessor in interest, Mr. Simon, in an exchange with our chairman, seemed to indicate that the kind of bright-line rule that we were discussing was not a good way to go. It would let by too many different kinds of communications and seem to be pushing us more towards the you'll know it if you see it kind of rule. I mean, do you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure which of your seven alternatives you're referring to with regards to your proposals that Mr. Simon disagreed with. But as a general matter, I think that our proposal establishes bright lines, very bright lines, within 120 days of an election. And outside of 120 days of an election, we use a qualification or a bright line that this commission itself proposed in its 2002 regulations for non-committee, non-527 groups, which is including a character or qualifications or fitness for office provision. This is something the commission proposed in 2002, did not adopt, but something that we supported then and we continue to support now.
Let me ask you again. I'm sorry, my time up.
And we'll have time for a second round.
That's fine.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'd like to start with Mr. Elias. As I understand your comments, you've endorsed an exemption for solicitations that federal candidates and office holders might make on behalf of your client or the DNC or the senatorial committee. And the first question I have for you is, would you be comfortable if we fashioned such an exemption that it would proceed and would be exempt, provided that the federal office holder or candidate who signs the solicitation, there's no express advocacy in the solicitation piece on that person's behalf, but otherwise it would be exempt?
Sure.
You'd be comfortable with
that? Yeah, I think that the, again, it's one of these quirks of the rules that I don't think was intended 2 years ago, that read literally. Again, I don't think in the spirit, and I don't even know if my colleagues would disagree with this, that where there is a direct mail solicitation that is clearly aimed at raising money for the party, not at promoting the candidate. If Mrs. Clinton signs a national appeal for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the fact that she is technically a candidate in New York, where she is, as we know, running virtually unopposed, and where the mail will be sent nationally, and yes, some pieces of it, some number of the pieces will go into New York, but its only purpose is to raise money for the DSCC. It's not to promote Mrs. Clinton's candidacy. It makes no sense. And frankly, I would argue that under the statute, it is not for the purpose of influencing a federal election. It cannot be regulated. And it shouldn't be regulated by the coordination rules.
And is the need for this kind of exemption arise because in the real world of politics, federal office holders who are signing these kinds of pieces, their people are necessarily going to look at the piece before it goes out, and therefore the conduct prong would be triggered?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I thought that the advisory opinion that this commission approved on with respect to Forgy Kerr was wrongly decided. Of course, you're not going to have a candidate who's going to sign a piece of direct mail or appear in an endorsement ad where they do not have some, at least, awareness and veto power over, for good taste, if nothing else, what's being said. As you know, these mail pieces tend to run fairly hot on both sides.
We sense that they have some volatile language occasionally. So your point essentially is that the content standard, therefore, is needed, and an exemption in this area is needed, or else it's going to be difficult for these candidates and office holders to sign these pieces, these fundraising pieces for these committees.
Right.
Do you have the same analysis with respect to the endorsement area? Would you be comfortable if we had an exemption for endorsements as long as the endorsement did not contain express advocacy for the candidate who's doing the endorsing?
I do, and I will say this again as here on behalf of the DSCC, but as the general counsel of the Kerry Edwards campaign, there were a few things this commission did last cycle which made less sense than telling George Bush he could not appear in an ad to endorse a candidate in Kentucky in a special election because he was theoretically, I guess, facing a primary election within 120 days in that state. I mean, there was we never had any doubt in the Kerry Edwards campaign that George Bush was going to be the Republican nominee, irrespective of what the Kentucky primary showed.
You're saying that Kentucky primary was not going to be that exciting.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Ryan, do you agree, you feel comfortable with exemptions along these lines for solicitation pieces and for endorsements?
We don't support the creation of a wholesale exemption in these contexts. We did propose in our comments that a for the purpose of influencing test or the expenditure definition itself be applied to federal political committees.
What would that mean?
I think that it creates a general presumption that most of the activities by political party committees are for the purpose of influencing federal elections. And this is a presumption that was recognized by the Supreme Court in Buckley and has been repeatedly recognized by courts in Buckley's progeny. But there will be circumstances in which, and the hypothetical that Mr. Norton gave in the first round of questioning was a good one, in my opinion, at illustrating the degree to which or the manner in which an endorsement could be abused and could, in fact, be for the purpose of influencing election. And if you create a carve-out for this type of endorsement without defining with a fairly high level of specificity what constitutes an endorsement that falls within your exception, you allow that type of activity to take place. And
is that because you would view it as possibly promoting, attacking, supporting, or opposing the endorsing candidate? Has the potential to do that?
It certainly has the potential to do that.
And therefore problematic.
Problematic, and you had suggested the incorporation of an express advocacy test as sort of filtering out those rather than a PASO test. I think the express advocacy test, having been described by the Supreme Court as functionally meaningless, is not a standard that this commission should continue to build its regulations upon.
In the advisory opinion we rendered a couple years ago on behalf of Senator Bayh, who wished to endorse a local candidate in Indiana, there the commission concluded that the added issue did not promote a tax support or oppose Senator Bayh, and I don't have the ad script in front of me, but the guts of it was the senator appearing in the spot on behalf of this candidate for mayor of Evansville, I believe. And, you know, it's as these spots normally are. The senator appeared, there was an American flag in the backdrop, and emphasized what a terrific person this local candidate was and that he supported this person's election. Do you believe the agency erred in concluding that that ad did not promote or support Senator Bayh?
Now, to have a definitive answer, I would have to look at the advisory opinion itself again. But generally speaking, I think the Commission's approach of using the advisory opinion process to address these questions is a good one. Was that 2004-1?
It was in that time period.
There's an advisory I don't think it was 2004-1.
2004-1 was 4 Geek Hurley.
Okay, there was.
You're thinking of Wine's Apple.
But the 2004-1 advisory opinion, which was noted in the NPRM and discussed in some comments that were submitted to you, and I think that illustrates the right approach in this commission, applying your coordination rule and determining that the ad in question did not constitute an expenditure under federal law.
So it would be a case-by-case analysis where we essentially would determine what you know, we know it when we see it kind of approach? I mean, is that fair?
Yes.
And Mr. Elias, your thoughts on that methodology?
Let me just say that to be clear, that advisory opinion was not sought on behalf of Senator Bayh. It was actually sought on behalf of Wine's Apple, who is a state
candidate. Right, okay.
And I will tell you that I had significant reservations, although the result worked out fine.
Were you concerned that we might find that it did promote or support?
No, I was concerned, frankly, that a United States senator who wants to endorse a mayoral candidate in a mayoral election needs to submit not only for an advisory opinion, but then was asked, and this is not a criticism of the General Counsel's Office, because they need, once a request is in, they need complete information. They need the script. They need the storyboards. I mean, the idea that somehow candidates should be coming to the federal government to seek prior approval of television ads that are aimed at endorsing non-federal candidates is a bit of a, you know, I'm not sure that's a process that we want to deem to be the norm. I mean, I understand when the law.
You don't want us to just tee up the videotape and take a look at this stuff and,
you know,
make an assessment.
To go ad by ad would be a bit of a you know, I understand there was a reason in that particular case. It was a new statute, a new regulation needed to interpret it. But for this commission to adopt as a regular practice that we will simply troop in each of our ads so that you all can judge whether they are or not are appropriate before they run. Presents both, I think, some constitutional concerns. It also poses, frankly, some logistical concerns, because, as you know, although you move expeditiously.
We have very good audio-video equipment. We can get the ad right up there in an open session, take a good look at it. But you're saying that these issues to be solved, if we had an exemption for endorsements that was conditioned on the absence of express advocacy for the endorsing candidate.
That would be acceptable.
Okay, my time has expired. Mr. General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gold, I'd like to start with you, if I could, and try to run a hypothetical by you. Let's say that candidate approaches your client 5 or 6 months, 4 months before the election and says, you know, I've been picking up tremendous ground on my opponent, who's an incumbent, hammering away on the jobs issue, jobs going overseas, and the candidate office holder failing to do enough to keep jobs here. But it looks like I'm going to run out of money, or at least a good bit of it, and not be able to run TV ads in the last couple of months. Is there any way you can step in and run ads attacking my opponent on this issue? And they sit and they talk about it, and they fashion an ad, and the tagline is going to be something like, you know, Candidate Jones, not good for workers, not good for America, There's no exhortation for the public to contact the candidate, so as I understand the safe harbor that you've embraced, it wouldn't be covered there. Should that be coordination under the commission's regulations, or should there be some exclusion for that?
Well, it doesn't fall within the safe harbor for a number of reasons. It's both really the content and the origin of it, in a sense. Even though the safe harbor talks about content and you're describing conduct, as far as the initial engagement.
Let me just interrupt you for one second. Yeah. I guess the question I'm going at is, okay, do we need a content standard to determine whether that's coordination? Does it matter?
No, from the hypothetical, the request is specifically electoral, and it's purely in the candidate's candidate capacity. That's the approach, and it's purely for an electoral purpose. So, in one sense, in one sense, it doesn't matter what the content is that results from it. So, I don't know that you need that. We have also, with respect to the 4 to 6 months, we haven't fixed a precise line. We're not suggesting that there is a precise line that you need to follow, temporal line. Is between. I'm not sure I'm being responsive.
One of the proposals that appears in Mr. Ryan's comments is that if there's a request or a suggestion request to run an ad in the kind of scenario I'm describing, then under that conduct, if you've got that conduct prong satisfied, then there is no need to look at a content standard to satisfy the commission that we have coordination. And what I'm hearing is, you agree with that?
If your hypothetical, though, is that the ad actually attack a candidate, right? That's the premise. Mm-hmm. And there is a content standard there, then, that is relevant. I mean, there is a reference to candidate. In response to Commissioner Mason, I suggested that whatever the affirmative standard is, there it ought to include a reference to a candidate. So in that sense, I think in that hypothetical, a content standard that we would imagine would be satisfied and the safe harbor would not apply.
Lots of the discussion today, and I'm sure well into tomorrow, is all about trying to establish some distinction, whether it's temporal or it's based on a content analysis that distinguishes between lobbying and grassroots communications on the one hand and electoral communications on the other. A question to any of you as a practical matter, is there a significant percentage of ads that really do both, that may be predominantly intended to serve, let's say, a lobbying purpose, stop filibustering employees, stop allowing U.S. jobs to go overseas, but also have the effect, if not some purpose, of discouraging support for the office holders? Is this a false dichotomy to be chasing here?
Well, if I can answer it, I think that since Buckley, the Supreme Court has recognized that speech and messaging can be mixed, that you can't easily separate out elections on the one hand from legislation on the other. That's a reality. And you can err in one direction, which I think the electioneering communication literally and read without any notion of an as-applied challenge, for example, can, where you sweep everything into one side or the other. The Supreme Court clearly rejected that earlier this week. But as a practical matter, you've got to make some practical decisions, and this goes back to what we were saying earlier. You are not going to be able to devise, I think, a rule that absolutely falls on some sharp line, but the Court of Appeals didn't say that you had to do it. Remember, the Court of Appeals said that you need to come up with some bright line standard that does not unduly compromise the purposes of the Act, which I think was a recognition that real life is ambiguous and messy, and you need to do something that is sufficiently protective, but you're not going to capture every conceivable situation. And it also goes to the other reality that Mr. Elias and I think were describing, was even in this last cycle, beyond the 120 days, the kind of free-for-all that the Court of Appeals mentioned and that Mr. Ryan is suggesting, it really didn't happen, and it's not likely to happen. So I think that ought to inform your judgments on this.
If I can just amplify that last point just very, very briefly, which is that and I know that no one is trying to impugn our integrity, but we are constantly being told that lawyers like Mr. Gold and I spend all of our waking moments trying to exploit loopholes on behalf of willing clients who do not want to do nothing other than exploit loopholes in the campaign finance laws. If, in fact, that characterization, which is often made of us and our clients, is true, ask yourself, then why didn't this happen? I mean, it's either because our clients are not quite as interested in exploiting loopholes as it is sometimes portrayed, or it's because these loopholes aren't really there. And I would just argue that under either circumstances, as this agency goes forward, there's been a lot of questions, and obviously you all asked the questions. You're the commissioners. You got appointed by the president. You know, that's all your business. But there has not been a lot of focus on what the burden is that is placed, the institutional burdens that are placed on these organizations to comply with these rules. And to have all of that burden, you know, there's that certification that when new rules get passed about how, you know, there's no that this thing doesn't cause a big regulatory burden. I hope we don't have one of those certifications on this one, because this causes an enormous regulatory burden on the people who have to deal with it. And the fact is, if it isn't going on, you ought not to burden it.
Can I just respond briefly to Mr. Norton's question or comment? The fact that a communication may do both lobby and influence an election does not in any way create a free pass for that ad simply because it can be construed as lobbying. This commission's actions are most certainly constrained by the statutory definition of expenditure, which is means for the purpose of influencing an election. But the Supreme Court has never indicated that expenditures related to lobbying cannot corrupt a candidate. You know, so what we're dealing with here, in the context when an ad combines both lobbying and campaign activity, the campaign activity itself, that component of the ad, can rightfully subject the ad to regulation by this commission, notwithstanding the lobbying component. And as we've seen the Abramoff scandal that's unfolding here in D.C., expenditures related to lobbying can likewise corrupt politicians. At the end of the day, that's not within this commission's jurisdiction, but that's only because Congress chose to take a more balkanized approach to regulating lobbying or deciding not to regulate lobbying versus campaign activity. But it's not a constitutionally required line.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. I think we were all trying to predict when Mr. Abramoff's name would come up in this hearing, and there we have it. Mr. Costa.
I have no questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Costa. We have ample time for a second round of questioning. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Mr. Ryan's comment, I think the reason why Congress chose to balkanize it is because no one would want to serve on the Federal Corruption Commission. I want to follow up a little bit on some comments Mr. Elias was making, but I want to start by asking Mr. Ryan a question. My sense is from reading the materials that you've submitted that as you've described in your testimony today, that there was roughly 200 ads that occurred outside of the 120-day time period, which you've interpreted to be to influence an election in large part because most of those ads were run by candidates running for office, and that there was a subset of them that were run by outside groups. Do you recall off the top of your head? I think it's in your written submissions. I can't recall how many or what percentage of the ads were run by outside groups.
Actually, we don't specify in our comments the percentage run by, nor have we calculated the percentage run by candidates versus outside groups.
Do you know the number that were run by outside groups, number of ads?
No, not off the top of my head, and it's not in our comments.
Okay. Is it significant for us, as we look at this record, the degree to which outside groups are active outside of the 120-day time period?
I think it depends on the particular election cycle and the office that you're looking at. In Senate and congressional races, for example, I think the vast majority of the ads in our appendices are by candidates themselves, and independent groups appear to be less likely to get involved in those races. In presidential election races, by contrast, there were a far greater percentage of independent groups running ads.
Okay. You've indicated both that depending upon the race, the involvement of outside groups varies, and depending upon the race, the degree to which people are spending before or after the primaries varies. Do you think we should have different rules for different kinds of races?
I don't think so. Simply because First off, getting back to some comments that were made in the first panel, Mr. Barron had indicated that our appendices, the material in our appendices was irrelevant more or less because it was candidate ads, not outside group ads. Mr. Simon attempted to point out, and you, Vice Chairman, seemed to acknowledge that, well, you didn't go as far as Mr. Simon, but Mr. Simon argued that the candidate ads themselves were, in fact, the best evidence available because what the circuit court was interested in was whether or not candidates run these ads. If candidates do run these ads, it's apparent that candidates find these ads useful. And what we're talking about in this rulemaking is the extent to which in-kind contributions are made to candidates. So outside groups, I think that if you were to draw those distinctions in your own regulations, outside groups versus candidates, in a manner that exempted outside groups to some extent from your regulations or to a large extent, then you would see a migration of the ads that had previously been run by candidates then being run by outside groups, but coordinated with those candidates who have already demonstrated the value that they perceive to exist in running ads early. And this is a trend that's been growing since, you know, the 96 presidential election. It's no secret. Every year you see candidate ads running earlier and earlier, and if they could get someone else to pay for it, why wouldn't they do so?
If the outside groups aren't buying ads in these time periods outside of the 120-day reasons, 120-day window, are there reasons for it that may exist in our current regulations or in the cultures in which they're? I mean, is that the ads aren't deemed effective? What is the barrier? Why aren't they doing it?
I'm not sure of a precise answer to that question. It may be the simple fact that outside groups often engage in a variety of activities, and as the election approaches, they become more interested in the approaching election. But we do believe that the 120-day line that excludes them if their ads run outside of it is not adequate in capturing when they start becoming interested in these ads. And perhaps one of the most interesting examples of this included in our appendices is an ad run by an organization affiliated with Public Campaign, another reform organization. I believe it ran in February of 2003, roughly a year before the presidential primaries and caucuses began. And the ad buy was only in New Hampshire and Iowa, and it was the ad buy itself that clearly evidences what the organization's intent and purpose was.
Mr. Gold, do you have a comment on this?
Yeah. Mr. Ryan says that there or perceives a trend of candidates running ads earlier and earlier, and let's say that's true. At the same time, in the same political culture, non-candidate, non-party groups are not doing that, apparently. Now, they relied on an extensive record that they developed, Brennan Center and the like, in order to convince the Supreme Court to regulate certain ads within 30 and 60-day time frames, because that's what happened. But here before you, when there is a comparable record of nothing or virtually nothing, they say, but it will happen, and therefore you should regulate there. This is not taking a consistent approach. If they have the evidence, you got to regulate it. If they don't have the evidence, you're going to have to regulate it anyway. And he hasn't addressed the fact that in an entire election cycle of 120 days, there's no record of any of this happening. Leave aside coordination. Just the advocacy that could be coordinated.
Yeah,
let me just offer one, and I realize that picking any one race is not all that helpful to the record, but it's more helpful than nothing, I suppose, which is that let's assume, as Mr. Gold says, that in fact there is a trend of candidates running earlier and earlier ads. No place would you have expected to see this then would have been more than would have been South Dakota. Okay, you had a Senate race, cheap media, high-profile race, leader of the Democratic Party running against now Senator Thune, who was clearly recruited by the White House and where the White House was interested. So if ever there was going to be the race where there was going to be that handoff, okay, hey, AFL-CIO, it's Senator Daschle. There was no higher priority, presumably, within the AFL-CIO than preserving Senator Daschle's seat. Hey, DSCC, go protect your guy. Here's the handoff. If you would have seen that, you would have seen it in South Dakota, where the barriers to running media were very low because of cost, and the risk-reward was so high because of the importance of the race, and you just didn't see it. I mean, you just didn't see it. Yes, it is true. The candidates were up on the media. They were up on media March in advance, you know, March of 04. So they had need. They were running their own campaign ads, and they ran their campaign ads from March of 04 until Election Day. And if there were this problem out there, you would have expected that you wouldn't have seen the candidate ads go up in March of 04 or April of 04. You would have seen these third-party groups go up. There would have been this handoff. And, you know, I think that as you all regulate in this area, I would submit that what is most important for you all to do is to not speculate what someday might be. God knows you'll still be around, and you'll be able to re-regulate and change your regulations to accommodate the changing times. Something I said in the rulemaking on the Internet. If there becomes abuse, then file a new NPRM. The Brennan Center, the Democracy 21, I'm sure they'll help you along. They'll say, hold a new rulemaking. But where we are right now, this just isn't happening.
I'm sorry, I have no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Mr. Elias, your comments, as I understand it, endorsed a proposed exemption for the use of publicly available information, this proposed 109.21G, which would have two dimensions. It would make clear that the conduct prongs are not triggered if outside groups or others use publicly available information in connection with making a public communication, and also that those conduct prongs wouldn't be triggered if those same groups or individuals had information conveyed to them by a candidate or his or her campaign, if that information is also publicly available. Are you comfortable with both elements of that proposed exemption? And my specific question is it your view that regardless of whether or not the information is shared by a candidate or a campaign, that the bottom line in terms of how we ought to treat it is whether it's publicly available?
Yeah, I think that is the dividing line. The fact
why
is
that, do you think?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. The fact is that I joked when you first passed your regulations and I do these briefings that there is an entire industry in Washington, D.C. of sharing the project's plans and needs. That's what you do if you're a candidate. You advertise why it is groups should care about you. You advertise why, especially if you're a challenger, you try to provide public information. You may hand out a poll that says, hey, look, I really am a viable candidate. I'm not a second-tier candidate. I'm not a third-tier candidate. I got a chance of winning. And here's what Charlie Cook has said about my race. Here's what the New York Times has written about my race. And, you know, if all that they are doing is distributing information that is otherwise public, you know, the party committees regularly put out these race updates where they list, you know, here is the latest in Montana. Here is the latest in Michigan. And it's just a compilation of, you know, of public polls, of public quotes. And all they're doing is providing that information. You know, it strikes me that poses a little, if any, risk of violating, you know, anything that should cause anyone heartburn. That's just people trying to provide to the public information about why their race is competitive or what's going on in their race.
Does your position boil down to a view that if the information is publicly available, that as a matter of law it can't be material to the making of a communication within the meaning of our conduct prongs, and therefore it doesn't matter if the manner in which that publicly available information is shared is through a candidate or campaign?
I think materiality would be one way of getting at it. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but that would be, I suppose, one way to conceive.
Mr. Gold, your thoughts on this in terms of use of publicly available information?
Well, generally the rule on using information from a campaign or about a campaign has been that it's non-public, that there's something of value there that the group then uses to fashion its communication. It seems to me, absent a request or a suggestion or some kind of involvement in the communication itself, the fact that a candidate is sharing public information should not be a factor in determining whether a subsequent communication is coordinated, absent satisfaction of a conduct standard. It could be if a candidate, on the other hand, says, you know, look, all this information, the Cook Report, my press releases, and shows that, you know, the polling shows that I'm incredibly weak in this portion of the state or my district. And it would be really helpful if somebody would highlight my record on X there. That, you know, if that's a request or suggestion, that's another matter.
I, as I understand your comments, Mr. Gold, you recommend that we abolish the common vendor and former employee conduct prongs, I guess on the grounds that they're overly broad and we can handle those types of actors through an agency analysis. Is that your view?
Yeah, in essence, that's right. And let me say my colleague Peggy McCormick is going to specifically try to focus on that when she testifies tomorrow. But in a nutshell, That's right. I mean, I think one of the most problematic portions of the regulation, and this would be my answer to Commissioner von Spakovsky's question about, is there anything else in the standard that has caused, you know, problems for the the current rules for the regulated community? I think I might first point to this, in addition to the fact that you have a mere reference standard within 120 days, which we think is improper. But the thing about the common vendor and former employee standard that is I think most vexing is that it's what I call non-coordination coordination. You can have coordination merely by knowledge that is used or conveyed somehow by somebody who is currently common vendor or that is a former employee, somebody who's no longer even working for a candidate or a party, where neither party to the coordination relationship, the candidate or party here and the group there, is even aware that this information is being passed, let alone used. And that just seems to be so far afield from any legitimate concern about corruption or the appearance of corruption, let alone resulting in something that the candidate believes has value. Remember what the Supreme Court said in Buckley about independent expenditures, that this is a good opportunity to repeal that. And we appreciate the fact that you are raising this in this rulemaking, even though it was not part of the remand.
Thank you. My time has expired. Thank you. Commissioner Mason.
Mr. Elias, you seem to say that we ought to just disregard communications interchanges between your committee and the members of your committee. And I sort of read your testimony saying that, and I'm in part sympathetic, you know, along the basis that I discussed before about, for instance, generic party advertising, whether it's the NRSC or the DNC or a state party committee or whatever. But I'm just trying to figure out, under the standard you're proposing to us, how do we tell when something is a 441 AD expenditure and when it isn't?
Well, the question of what is a 441 AD expenditure and is not is something that this commission has frankly passed on explaining to the parties for forever. I don't know how many times it's come up as a possibility that the commission would define. I know it has come up at least on two occasions where there.
Let me then posit a standard for you. I mean, have we not implicitly answered it in the coordination regulation by saying that if it's a public communication that identifies a candidate targeted to the electorate within 120 days?
Yes.
Then that, in essence. Other things might also be 441
right,
AD expenditures,
okay.
But that at least, and so that would be the operative distinction. And what I'm trying to understand is if you have some disagreement with that. In other words,
no, I think that's right. I think that a communication within whatever time period is prescribed under whatever rules would qualify as 441 AD if not made independently, and otherwise it would not.
And you don't, and just in that context, and in the context of trying to allow your committee's members to work with the committee on generic messages and generic campaign strategy, but also prevent your committee from violating the 441 AD limits, you don't have a real problem with that standard or a standard very similar to that.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You confused me before you went out of order, and then I was all flummoxed. Mr. Ryan, I have, as I think I've indicated, a number of concerns about your proposal. In addition to the APA issues, which are really real to me, because I'm not looking to write a rule that's going to just set us up for another losing court battle. In addition to the complexity, and you can say it's not complicated or more complicated than other proposals, but I'll just tell you that I think we're a reasonably intelligent group of people up here, reasonably well-versed in the law, and we were comparing notes on how many times we had to read it before we got what you were trying to say. And it was more than one. It was, you know, like four or five times we had to read through your proposal to figure it out. It just doesn't make a lot of sense on first go-through. It also uses the word coordinate or coordinated numerous times in the course of defining what a coordinated activity would be, which is completely, frankly, unhelpful. So I have a lot of issues with the way the proposal is drafted and what we could do with it. But I also, just on a conceptual level, I'm confused by one aspect of it. there's this tiered set of restrictions, and the most restrictions go to political committees, which are, if they're federal political committees, all hard money entities. And the fewest restrictions seem to pertain to the activities of corporations and labor unions, which are the stereotypical soft money providers. So I don't really get that. Why do you provide more leeway for corporations and unions than you do for political committees? And then, of course, the 527 is somewhere in between.
Well, to some extent, it's because of the nature of the organizations themselves and their purpose. If a political committee, if the purpose of a political committee is to influence federal elections, and the courts have recognized this, that's the overwhelming purpose of these groups. Likewise, with 527 organizations, they have a major purpose of influencing candidate elections. We believe, as a result, that there should be a higher level of presumption that their activities fall within the scope of the statutory definition of what expenditure, which is for the purpose of influencing elections.
But if we're trying to limit soft money, wouldn't we be more interested in the sources of soft money than the sources of hard money?
Well, limiting soft money is one of the goals of this. Another goal of this proposal is to regulate what should be considered in-kind contributions to candidates. Whether hard or soft, there are limits on the amount and source of these contributions. And so we have competing goals. One is, or I shouldn't characterize them as competing goals. We have several goals. One is to simply define with a fairly high degree of specificity what constitutes in-kind contribution as a result of coordination that occurred. The second is to deal with these outside organizations, persons other than political committees or 527 organizations. The simple fact, as has been stated by both commissioners in this rulemaking and commenters in the first panel on this one, is that these organizations that are not self-identified as having a major purpose of influencing candidate elections engage in a bunch of different types of activity, and we try to maintain an appropriate level of latitude for these organizations to engage in activity that does not influence federal elections, but nevertheless to capture the activity of those organizations that is intended to influence federal elections. And getting back to the question you posed to me in the first round of questioning, I think it's a very important one. And with regard to, doesn't 441B really capture this stuff, absent amendments to the coordination regulation that we propose? I think the best evidence that it does not is the soft money spending that occurred prior to the passage of the McCain-Feingold law. And the McCain-Feingold law was directly targeted at addressing the problem within 30 and 60 days of an election. But the McCain-Feingold law was also specifically addressed to targeting independent activity. When you're dealing with activity that's coordinated between a federal candidate and an independent group, I think the presumptions change with regard to the degree to which that communication is likely of value to the candidate and therefore holds the potential to corrupt that candidate. And that's why the references to the buying time studies, I think they aren't dispositive of this issue. The fact that the buying time studies focused on 30 and 60-day time frames is simply a reflection of the fact that those proponents of McCain-Feingold law that were trying to get it passed knew that they had to demonstrate that their proposal with regard to independent spending was narrowly tailored to address a very concrete problem.
But the question that I asked you about was this issue of somebody handing off their advertising to an outside person and having them pay for it, and I'm not aware of any evidence in Buying Time or anywhere else that says that was a prevalent practice then, now, or in between.
But Buying Time, again, did not look at coordinated activity.
Right, so there's no evidence there.
The evidence is in our...
So we don't have the record.
Evidence is in our appendices that these ads occur and they could be coordinated under
your rule. They could be coordinated.
Yes.
But they could not be coordinated. We have no evidence that they are coordinated, that it's been a problem, that it's happened.
And given your exclusion of these types of ads from your own regulations, we would have no way of knowing whether they were coordinated. They're not required to be reported.
Are you suggesting that our friends here are lying? I mean, they've just said it just doesn't happen.
I'm saying that it would be interesting to bring in to this group or representatives of organizations across the country who aren't political attorneys, who aren't going to sit before you and simply assert that, no, we didn't coordinate any of this stuff, and actually elicit from them information with regards to conversations they may have had with federal candidates with regard to ads that they ran prior to elections. And in addition to that,
I'll make a deal. If that'll settle this, then done. Okay, if I can bring, if we can agree, we'll bring in Harold Ickes and we'll bring in Mary Beth Cahill, and if at the end of that they swear under oath that they didn't coordinate these ads outside of 120 days, they withdraw their proposal and we go the other way, and that's a factual record deal.
That, will you give us the time to do that?
Because I want to see where, I mean, you can, the record is not, it's not just what we've said. At the time this activity was going on, it was in the newspaper. These groups on the left, on the right, in the center, Democrat, Republican, were all saying they didn't coordinate. And there wasn't any evidence that they were coordinated, that they were doing this handoff at the time.
The reason it doesn't settle the issue is because Congress and the court in McConnell have recognized that Congress may, and this commission should, in fact, act prophylactically to address problems that are likely to arise. The soft money loophole took 20-plus years to explode, and this is, you know, this is an area of the law. This is an exemption, a loophole, so to speak, that, when given the green light, might explode in the course of one election
cycle. So we should act to restrict First Amendment activity because something bad might happen, but we have absolutely no record evidence that it ever has happened.
What you would be restricting are communications that result from coordination with federal officials.
One thing that struck me about looking at your proposal was that it's different from the proposal that you and your colleagues submitted in 2002, the last time that the commission submitted that. And the reason that it's different, I think, is because you looked at what happened in one election cycle and you said, aha, we've identified some problems as a result of the experience under one cycle of BCRA that we think ought to be addressed in this rule. Isn't that the fact that your position has changed in one cycle? And I suspect that whatever we do to the rule, you'll identify more problems. So in the interest of our not doing a coordination rulemaking every 2 years, isn't that an argument for our saying, let's do the minimum possible that we need to now, make the minimum change that is necessary to address the Court of Appeals concerns, and watch what happens over two or three cycles and see what actually does happen, and then we'll see what the problems are and what we need to regulate.
Your assumptions regarding why our position has changed, why our proposals in 2002 differ from those submitted in this rulemaking, is incorrect. The precise reason that our proposal differs in this rulemaking is because we were attempting to work with the regulation that's currently on the books, to work with components of the seven alternatives presented in the NPRM, to craft something that would be acceptable to us that would accurately interpret congressional intent in BCRA. We considered whether we should just resubmit our comments from 2002, but we chose instead to work with your existing rule, and that's what we did.
So it doesn't reflect any experience in the first cycle?
Oh, we didn't discount or ignore any experience that we had, but the primary purpose that we submitted comments that differ in this rulemaking and didn't resubmit our 2002 comments are because we attempted to work with the rule that you've had that you have on the books, for the same reasons that Mr. Barron and some of my colleagues here frequently advocate this commission change the rules as little as they have to. The regulated community has been living under these rules. Let's get rules that work, and if we can do it based on what is currently on the books, then that may be preferential or beneficial.
I'm way over my time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we're intruding on our lunch hour, so I'll try to limit myself to two questions. Famous last words from a lawyer. Mr. Ryan, I'd like to follow up on the point made by Commissioner Weintraub, which I think was a very good point, which is that the rule that you're proposing is, frankly, so complex that, and I think I'm a fairly competent lawyer, it took a while and several times reading it to try to understand it, which to me says that the large organizations in Washington who are involved in the political process, many of them who've been represented on the panels here today, and who have plenty of money, and who can afford the very expensive specialists in Washington who do this kind of law, are going to be able to comply with these rules. But the people who aren't going to be able to do it are the many organizations and individuals outside of Washington, down in the grassroots, who don't have that kind of money, who can't hire expensive Washington lawyers to try to understand a very complex rule. And do you really believe that the kind of rule that you're proposing is not going to chill participation in the election and campaign process in this country?
I I don't believe so. I don't believe it will chill such speech unnecessarily. I think that the rule that we propose is not as complicated as it may come across at first glance, and I can distill into a couple sentences what it does. Outside of 120 days of an election, it applies a character or qualifications test to non-committee, non-527 organizations, and a PASO test to 527 organizations. Within 120 days, it's a stricter, even more bright-line test having to do with whether the communication clearly identifies a candidate within 120 days or whether it simply meets the conduct standards within 30 or 60 days. That's not an incredibly complicated rule. And on top of this, the 527 provisions, which constitute a third of the bulk of our proposed rule, in our mind, are an unfortunate necessity in this rulemaking. We are essentially rehashing out the 527 battle in the context of this rulemaking because we refuse to punt on the issue here and let it slide. But if this commission were to adopt a more functional, in our opinion, definition of what constitutes a political committee, and specifically the major test component of the Supreme Court's gloss on the statutory definition of that term, a third of this regulatory proposal could be thrown out. We would be dealing with federal political committees and other entities, and the rule would be drastically simplified. Unfortunately, you chose, not all of you individually, but as an institution, this committee, or this commission chose not to do so, and here we are with a slightly more complicated rule than we otherwise would have needed to have.
All right, my final question. I'm going to ask you another hypothetical, although it won't be the same one I asked Mr. Simon this morning. But the hypothetical I want to ask you about is actually something based on current events and something I actually heard, an advertisement on probably one of the more obscure radio stations I listen to. There's been a lot of criticism started in the newspapers and now has migrated its way into political advertisements of the president over the NSA intercept program and over the stories that broke about supposed secret CIA prisons in Europe. And I heard an ad that criticized the president, and the tenor of it was basically that he's grasping for power. And my question to you is, that kind of an ad, which said no more than that, but related those kind of events, if this were to occur in a presidential year, and the president were running for office again, would, if all the other rules for the coordination provisions were met, is the content of that ad going to fall within the rule as you put it forward so that if someone did that, the FEC should investigate, prosecute, and fine the individual organization who did that?
I think it necessarily depends on the identity or the tax status of the organization. If it's a 527 organization, promote a tax support or oppose test would be applied. If it's not a 527 organization, nor a federal political committee, then the test that under our proposal applies is that it refers to the character or qualifications or fitness for office. If it is the president's grabbing power, I don't think that would be or should be construed as referring to the character or qualifications or fitness for office of a candidate. It would not be subject to our content standards.
Okay, but you're saying there are some organizations where you think it would apply.
Possibly a federal political committee, because I think such an advertisement, if run during an election, presidential election year, could be construed as being for the purpose of influencing the elections.
Okay, so under that circumstance, you think we should fine the political committee for doing that?
Quite possibly. I mean, yeah, if, you know, it depends to some extent on the full text of the ad, but if that's all the ad said, I think this commission would quite possibly be within its authority to find that the ad was for the purpose of influencing the election and violated federal contribution limits if it did, in fact, exceed the amount limits.
Well, I hate to do this to you, Mr. Ryan, but does it give you any second thought at all that, in fact, if we were to fine an organization for doing that, we would be repeating behavior that occurred 200 years ago when Vermont Republican Matthew Lyon became the first person, dubious honor, to be fined $1,000 under the Alien and Sedition Act because, due to his opposition to going to war with France, he criticized the president by saying he was continuing to grasp for power?
Well, he would not be, because he would be subject to the character or qualifications or fitness for office test, which I explicitly stated would not be subject.
You just told me that we should fine someone under that circumstances. Now you're backing away from that.
A federal political committee.
I see.
Yes.
Can I comment on that? I mean, let's take the proposal, Mr. Ryan's proposal here, and let's take that ad, and let's assume that his interpretation of character qualifications and fitness doesn't apply to that. Some people might think it does, but let's say it doesn't. Under their proposal for a union or a corporation or an individual or a partnership, let's say, it would fall under the standard of a public communication directed to voters that refers to a candidate, and that applies from 120 days before the first primary through the general election. The first primary is in January, so we're talking, where are we, September of 2003 or 2007, up through the election. We could not, the AFL-CIO could not confer in any way that satisfies the conduct standard with the Democratic leader, okay, of the House or the Senate, or who's running for re-election, let's say, about doing advocacy that complains about that presidential conduct. That's what that's what their standard would do, and that's truly unacceptable.
And since others are commenting, let me just say that apropos of what Commissioner Weintraub asked, I do find it almost surreal that a corporation and labor union gets to accuse the president of grasping for power, but if the Democratic senators want to do so, then under this test it would be out of bounds. I mean, it's a weird dichotomy here, right? The soft money groups, they get to do it under this lower test, but if an organization comprised of the Democratic Senate, Democratic senators, they want to do it, then using hard money, I might add, using money that's regulated and reported, then it's somehow a higher burden. And I have to say, I too am perplexed by why it's rank ordered that way. I would think that actually the reform community would rather have it be done by a hard money committee and reported subject to limits than by a soft money committee. But, you know, it's their proposal.
Thank you, Commissioner Von Spakovsky. Mr. General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to be quick. Mr. Gold, you're one of the only witnesses, I think, or one of the only commenters who rejected the use of the temporal content standard, and so I feel like before you get away, I wanted to ask you if you wanted to elaborate a little bit on a comment that you make at the beginning, at the end of page 9 of your comments to the top of 10. I'm going to paraphrase a bit to save some time, but you say if we want to use a temporal standard, the Commission needs to determine how much lobbying occurs within the periods under consideration and therefore might be affected. You say not only have we failed to seek information, empirical information on that, but you are aware of none that could be used to support the existing regulation. The extent to which lobbying and similar activities may take place within any time period prior to an election depends entirely on the legislative calendar and may vary from year to year. In our experience, however, it is just as likely that significant lobbying will take place within 120 days or any similar period prior to an election as they will occur outside of that period. Under these circumstances, there's no basis for applying a different content standard depending upon when a communication occurs. I will say I've heard at different times other arguments that so much action is sort of loaded at the end of the calendar that that's in fact when a lot of lobbying is going on, coincident with a lot of electioneering, and it's that it's elections that galvanize lobbying and so on. But I wonder if you wanted to elaborate at all on your comments.
Well, I think what we say here and what we believe in our experience is that, you know, when important legislative activity occurs, To some degree, elections do cause it to happen. They do, because legislators, incumbents, want to do things that will influence elections through their legislative conduct. But that is hardly universally the case. And external circumstances, whether it's September 11, if it had been September 11, 2002, rather than 2001, you would have had the Patriot Act within 60 days of an election, for example. Appropriations committees are making their final decisions during that 60-day period every 2 years because October 1 is the end of the fiscal year. What we're basically saying here is it would be, I think we would perhaps ideally like to have a temporal standard because it's clean, but the reality is that, and I think given what the D.C. Circuit said, is absent a record that will satisfy them, and I'm mindful of your concern that you don't want to litigate and lose again, that may not be the best way to approach it, or certainly not the only way to approach it. And that's why we didn't go in that direction. We're really focusing on, we accept the conduct standards you have, and we're looking at some kind of definition of content that would not be so time sensitive, especially because lobbying legislative activity really is a year-round function.
The last question I had was, I guess I'd like to direct to you, Mr. Elias, and that's whether you can say anything in response to this concern about the so-called gap, that whether we use a 30 or 60-day, as you propose, or we use the 120-day, there's still this concern that with early primaries, there will be some period during the election season between the primary and the general election when there is no regulation in this area. What's the argument in response to that concern?
Well, my argument is twofold. At a general level, I would go back to what I said before, which is that we just don't have, I don't think that this commission has before it a record of that activity taking place in any significant extent. At a more precise level with respect to the DSCC, I want to end where I began, which is to point out that the DSCC is a hard money committee, and the activity that would be engaged in would be the DSCC spending hard money, money that's raised under limits and reported and fully reported during those periods. And I think that when you look at the risk that is posed to the system versus the burden, and I continue to come back to this because there is a significant burden, and some of it has been touched on today and some of it hasn't. The common vendor issue is a real burden that is placed on organizations like the DSCC. The need to set up the firewalls, the lack of a safe harbor right now for when you set up those firewalls. These are all regulatory burdens that I think in the hard money context make it a compelling argument.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Mr. Costa.
I have no questions.
Okay. Hearing none, then, this completes our second panel today. Commission thanks the panelists very much, and we will be in recess until 3 p.m. this afternoon, at which time we will hear from the third panel. Thank you.